From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, it's been almost 2 years since Hamas attacked Israel and took hundreds of hostages. Israeli policy analyst Shira Ephron says that Israel's aggressive military response raises sharp questions.
Israelis don't see in the news the images that the rest of the world sees from Gaza. But after 2 years, there's a question to be asked. In the name of what and to what end?
And later, Sean Combs is sentenced. An Oregon family on their mixed feelings about forced care for people who struggle with addiction and mental challenges. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, October 4, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Suicide is a grim subject across all backgrounds, but its risks are keenly felt in Indigenous communities. The statistics are equally grim. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that in 2022, the second leading cause of death for Native youths was suicide, and the overall death rate from suicide for American Indians and Alaska Natives was 91% higher than the total population. While prevalent, Bemidji State Professor Mark Bays says it's a difficult subject to talk about in Indigenous communities.
It's a very, very sensitive topic, and a lot of our people do not want to bring up something such as suicide, because we may believe that as soon as we bring the spirit about of death, then we bring it around our people and our community. So it's taboo to be speaking about death.
Bays is a member of the Tapalang Kawali Tekan Tribe's Waterbird Clan, sharing geography with Texas, and of Mohawk and Pawnee descent. He has practiced psychology and related fields for more than 15 years across Indian country and has published numerous articles. He says it was imperative to develop a screening tool that addresses the unique factors for suicide risk of Indigenous people.
It's important that we understand where we came and where we overcame and being resilient, but it's also just as important that we talk about generational healing, that we don't just talk about historical trauma and intergenerational trauma and say, thank y'all for coming and leave.
But developing screening questions that set it apart from westernized assessments was no easy task. After consulting with Indigenous peers in his field, he says he went old school for further research.
I needed to go into ceremony saying, Creator, we need to do something about our lives for those that continue to choose to take their life and how we can honor who they are and provide support and motivation and strategies to keep them alive and honor their spirit while they are alive.
Bay says the elders he consulted with agreed that something needed to be done and helped guide him toward the how.
We need to do it in a way that we do not, one, bring up that spirit. And to me, that's, as a psychologist, it's don't re-traumatize. Every time we ask, hey, you want to kill yourself? We're bringing that spirit back up. We have to change the language. This instrument that you want to create, it needs to be culturally responsive.
He says he spent several months developing the screening questions, ensuring they were culturally relevant while consulting with Indigenous practitioners until the elders gave him more advice.
They were saying you need to incorporate allies. And I was a little hesitant because I'm like, this is why we're in a predicament that we are, is because we have a lot of non-Native individuals that may not truly understand our way. So instead of providing that word or that question that should be presented, they may not ask it because I'm not Native and maybe I don't want to offend them. So let me just kind of bypass that. But the elders were saying the majority practitioners across the United States that are administering suicide screening tools are non-Native.
Consulting with non-Native mental health workers with multiple years of experience of working in Indian country helped fine-tune what's called the Indigenous Suicide Assessing Factors of Event Screening Tool, which is about to start its pilot study with tribal agencies neighboring Bemidji.
We want to make sure that it is able to identify risk factors for suicide in addition to being able to recognize and identify protective factors.
After the initial study, Bay says the next step is a larger pilot study including tribes across the United States. Bayes, in addition to his research and his role as assistant professor at Bemidji State, also co-directs the Indigenous Studies in the Psychology program at BSU and serves as president of the Society of Indian Psychologists. If you or a loved one has thoughts of suicide, help is available from the 988 Lifeline. It's a free, confidential mental health hotline that connects people with counselors 24/7 on matters beyond suicidal thoughts, such as economic worries, substance use disorder, intimate partner violence, and more. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The White House is using the government shutdown to advance plans to further cut the federal workforce and control spending. Budget Director Russell Vogt is calling on agencies to fire staffers who were deemed to be non-essential during the funding lapse. And the Trump administration says it is freezing billions of dollars for projects in states, many of whom voted for Kamala Harris. NPR Stephen Fowler joins us.
Good morning.
Let's begin first with the threats to fire federal workers. Has anyone actually been let go yet?
Well, so far, they're just threats. Here's White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt speaking to Morning Edition yesterday.
The president is meeting with the Office of Management and Budget to try to understand what agencies are essential, what agencies do not align with the administration's priorities and values.
Here's the thing to think about, though, Scott. Any of these reductions in force or RIF efforts that would come would have to be from the leaders of these federal agencies. President Trump can't make them happen, and neither can Russ Vogt, the head of the Office of Management and Budget. RIF rules are pretty particular about the amount of time and notice they have to give before they can take effect. There's also a lawsuit that's been filed from federal workers' unions saying that the threat of firing workers, especially during a shutdown, is illegal.
The administration's also announced several grants and projects are on hold just in the past few days and highlighted some in districts that are represented by Democrats. Is that related? How is it related to the shutdown?
Well, it depends on who you ask. The Energy Department says billions of dollars for clean energy grants are being canceled because of a review that found they, quote, did not adequately advance the nation's energy needs, were not economically viable, and would not provide a positive return on investment of taxpayer dollars. Others have noted that those projects are in more than a dozen states, including Minnesota and New York. All of them, Vice President Kamala Harris won in last year's presidential election. The timing of the announcement comes as the administration is doing a full court press to get Democrats to get on board with their plans to reopen the government.
Stephen, is this a lot like the DOGE effort that the president launched in January?
Well, that's the argument that Democrats are making. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said this in an NPR interview earlier this week.
The Trump administration has been out of control since day one. They've been laying people off since day one. They've been firing federal employees since day one, and they've been violating the law since day one.
DOGE's work to cancel contracts and direct agencies to slash their workforce is an extension of Trump and Vogt's long-held belief that the government should be smaller and spend less on things they don't agree with. Even as the White House has tried to circumvent the spending and budgeting power given to Congress, which Republicans have so far allowed to happen, it's worth noting that agencies have been hiring back hundreds of workers they let go earlier this year, and Treasury data shows spending has actually increased instead of decreased. That's because most of what the federal government spends its money on is mandatory items like Social Security and Medicare, popular programs, and things it would require Congress to change.
Of course, Stephen, there have been government shutdowns before. And new administrations try to change spending plans and establish new policy priorities. Is this shutdown that different?
Shutdowns are an inherently partisan thing. But this time, it has been notable, Scott, how Republicans are using official government communications to attack one political party. Earlier this week, the administration added language to internal memos, official government websites, out-of-office email signatures, and more to blame Democrats for the shutdown, and it's a potential violation of federal ethics laws. As a comparison, in 2013, former President Obama sent a letter to federal workers ahead of a shutdown, thanking them for what they do and chiding Congress for being responsible without mentioning Republicans specifically.
NPR's Stephen Fowler, who is part of our team that covers the restructuring of the federal government, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Two years on, an overwhelming majority of Israelis say they want an end to the war in Gaza to release the hostages, and that might become a reality soon. Yesterday, Hamas said it accepts President Trump's ceasefire plan and will release all remaining hostages, living and dead, after it negotiates some of the conditions. But how has the war in Gaza changed the way Israelis view themselves? Shara Efron is Distinguished Israel Policy Chair and Senior Fellow at RAND and joins us now from Tel Aviv. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can we go back to October 6th, 2 years ago, the day before the Hamas-led attacks on Israel? What was it like to be an Israeli?
I think on October 6th, felt anything was possible. On the personal level, we had just returned, my family and I, from a visit to Sinai in Egypt, crossing the border, speaking Arabic to our neighbors, you know, something that I really can't imagine us doing today. I remember an expert conversation exactly on October 6th, speaking about the lessons from the Yom Kippur War in 1973. And all the security analysts said, this something like this can never happen to us again. We will never face a strategic surprise like Yom Kippur. And then, of course, we woke up at 6:29 a.m. on October 7th, and the world couldn't have been more different.
So what does it feel like to be an Israeli now?
It's difficult. For many Israelis, October 7 is not over yet. Every day, there are more stories of what happened that day. You hear from survivors. More witnesses are coming out with stories. Obviously, Israelis that have gained the support of much of the international community early on are now facing unprecedented levels of isolation with divestments and boycotts, formal and informal. And so on the one hand, Israel's security environment changed remarkably since October 7, because in the last 2 years, Israel has taken actions that have changed fundamentally its borders with remarkable military achievements, but those have not been translated into strategic diplomatic victories. And of course, with the war in Gaza, that according to most Israelis was very legitimate on October 7, has no legitimacy today. And it has no legitimacy around the world. And even Israelis don't want the war to continue.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has been on trial for corruption. And of course, there have been huge demonstrations calling for him to reach a deal with Hamas for the release of all the remaining Israeli hostages. What's the state of his leadership now?
What we are seeing in every polling is that the Israeli public does not support neither the government's policies nor the government itself. So there is really a conundrum here because the prime minister and his coalition that are both, you know, advancing the continuation of the war, but it's not clear to the Israeli public and to others in around the world that this is done only because of a pure national security interest and not personal political interest of staying in power, knowing pretty well that if we go to elections, this current coalition has a very low chance of being reelected.
I mean, casting back to 1948 and the founding of Israel, Israel liked to to say that it aspired to be a light among nations. And now we have a situation where Israel's military campaign in Gaza is being criticized around the world, including by traditional allies. How does this affect Israel's view of itself?
I think it does two things. Israelis believe that they're held to an entirely different standard from other countries in the world. And while I can take this view and be sympathetic to Israel's frustration, clearly there is a willful blindness of Israelis, awful images from Gaza that, believe it or not, Israelis don't see in the news the images that the rest of the world sees from Gaza. They don't know what is happening in their name. But after 2 years, there's a question to be asked. In the name of what and to what end? Now, if Israel has an objective that I think Hamas, a terrorist, vicious, cruel, barbaric organization, should not be the de facto government of the Gaza Strip. You want to dismantle Hamas and change the governance in Gaza to one that doesn't pose a threat to Israel. That's fine, but limit on humanitarian aid, the lack of dignity for the Palestinian people. How is this going to help Israel's security in the long run?
You wrote recently in the New York Times, I'm going to quote you, Israelis must look beyond their own prism of pain and trauma, recognize the harsh reality in Gaza, then it must act. Act how? Do what?
Israelis can demand the increase of the humanitarian aid. The fact is that humanitarian assistance in Israel has been politicized to the extent that there are barely any Israelis who support it, including from the opposition. But those questions of the future of Gaza, the future of the Palestinian people, and not turning up, you know, this blind spot that we have to Palestinian nationalism, those questions are not going to go away.
Shira Efron is Distinguished Israel Policy Chair and Senior Fellow at RAND. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to NPR News.
After 8 o'clock, you're listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXC. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. At 10 o'clock this morning, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Coming up at 4 o'clock this afternoon, Nate Dorr, volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. And 7 o'clock, our ever-popular Green Cheese Trivia Show, Brandon Chase, your volunteer host for tonight. You can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You can save time and money while defending the KAXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. That's 855-277-2346.
KAXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid. Terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KAXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Sean Combs has been sentenced to more than 4 years in prison after a lengthy hearing in Manhattan yesterday. The rapper, producer, and businessman was convicted in July on two prostitution-related charges. Chloe Malas has covered the Combs trial for NBC News. She joins us from an airport now. Chloe, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
He was acquitted of the most serious charges, sex trafficking and racketeering. What are the two charges of which he's now been found guilty?
Those are two counts of something called the Mann Act. It's transportation to engage in prostitution. And he was found guilty by the jury over the summer of those two counts. But like you said, he was acquitted of the more serious charges, which he faced a life in prison sentence if convicted on those.
Well, tell us more about this sentence of about 4 years, because the judge could have handed down something lengthier, couldn't he?
So the judge could have given Combs up to 10 years on each count of the Mann Act, which means he could have faced up to 20 years in federal prison. The judge giving him 4 years and 2 months is actually quite a surprise, because it is less than what the probation department recommended, which was between 5 and 7 years. Now, it is not what Combs's legal team wanted, which was 14 months. I actually spoke to one of his attorneys, Brian Steele, last night outside of the courthouse following the judge's decision, and they said that they are very disappointed in this, and that all they want is Combs to come home, and that they plan to appeal.
We certainly heard a lot from Sean Combs' alleged victims during the trial. How did they receive news of the sentence?
One of the first individuals to react to the news of Combs' sentence was Cassie Ventura, his longtime girlfriend, who was a key witness in this trial. And in a statement through her attorney, she says that nothing can undo this trauma, but basically this is a step in the right direction, that this shows the serious nature of his crimes. The judge was very, very sympathetic towards Combs in a way in his final comments, saying, "I've read all of the letters that were sent on your behalf. I listened to your children cry in front of me. It's clear how much they love you and they need you." Combs cried in court. Combs begged for mercy. But at the same time, the judge was very supportive of the women who testified during the trial, and he specifically praised Cassie and another woman who testified under the pseudonym Jane.
Do we know what time and where Sean Combs reports?
So we don't know where he's going to be reporting to, but we do know that his team is planning to file paperwork on Monday with their recommendations as to where they would like to see him. There's a good chance that they're going to ask for home confinement, which the judge sentencing him to 50 months in federal prison, it would be highly unlikely that then he would decide to grant him the opportunity to be on house arrest, essentially. Through my reporting, I've learned that his team is very interested in him, obviously, going to what you call a camp. That's where Ghislaine Maxwell is, the type of place Martha Stewart was. But I think you'll see him at a federal prison, but a lower level in terms of security.
NBC News Entertainment correspondent Chloe Malas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now it's time for sports. Baseball playoffs divisional rounds begin today. Yankees and Dodgers want to repeat their pennants. Notice I've restrained myself for about 3 seconds for mentioning the Cubs. We're joined now by sports writer Howard Bryant. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Getting ready for game time. Let's begin with the National League. Going coast to coast. The Phillies are up against the defending champs, the LA Dodgers. Shohei Ohtani is going to return to the mound in this season. And then within God's own central time zone, the Chicago Cubs face the Milwaukee Brewers at Wrigley North. Look, the Phils and the Brew Crew had the best records in baseball this season. How do you see each series going?
Well, I think that going, you know, start with the champs. I mean, they're the champions, and they're the star-studded lineup, and they're the Dodgers that are the defending world champions, and that they're the team, they've been the team to beat for, what, the last 6 or 7 years. And so and to have Ohtani be on the mound as well, they are clearly the team that everyone is going to be watching to see how they do. However, their bullpen is not that great, and the Phillies ran away with the National League East. You could blame the Mets for that. You could blame the downfall of the Braves for that. But the bottom line is that the Phillies are also a very good team. They were in the World Series 3 years ago. So this is the powerhouse matchup in the National League. On the other hand, you've got the Brewers, who have been knocking on the door for the longest time. They were a really, really good team. They got stunned by the Mets last year. They came up short against the Dodgers. And so they, you know, and they were terrific all season long. And I think that the thing that you're watching with them is to really see if they can finally be the, you know, the ones to break through. They haven't won the World Series since, they haven't gotten to the World Series since they made it back in 1982. So a long wait for them. And then there's the Cubs. Your team, and they won 90 games this year. Very surprising team.
Go ahead.
And they have broken through, and I think that that's a team that had been in the slow rebuild, and I think that as a club, they're a very well-rounded team, and I think that each one of these teams has a really good chance to make a play, but it really is, if you're looking at it from a standpoint, it's the Dodgers and the Phillies that are probably the favorites coming, one of those two coming out of the National League.
Toronto Blue Jays and the Yankees, then the Detroit Tigers face the Seattle Mariners and their phenomenal catcher, Cal Raleigh. Who you got there?
I really love this matchup for a couple of reasons. One is that it's amazing that you've got a guy who's a catcher of all positions, the toughest, most physical position, hit 60 home runs, and we don't really know that much about him. It's great. This is what the playoffs is for. You can really see these guys that you haven't seen all season on the national stage. And 60 home runs, 125 RBIs. And Seattle is a very good team. Everyone I've spoken to talks about how underrated they are. They just play so far away, and they play on the West Coast that they'll sneak up on you. Meanwhile, the Tigers were terrible. They were a great team all season long and then completely collapsed in September. It got overtaken by Cleveland and then suddenly found a way to beat Cleveland in Cleveland, best 2 out of 3. So, I once again, I love both of these teams, and I'm looking really forward to seeing what happens. Meanwhile, Yankees and the Blue Jays, American League East, they've been battering each other all season long, and we'll see what the Yankees are made of. But I'd love to see the Blue Jays. They haven't gotten to the World Series since they won it in 1993 as well.
And just quickly, you know what I'd like to see return? Leaving starting pitchers in when they're doing well.
Yeah, it's been the story so far, the postseason. I love it. This is the thing that's been missing in baseball. We've been missing the fact that it's not this analytics-based assembly line pitching where you got 10 pitchers to get 27 outs. I want to see Curt Schilling. I want to see Bob Gibson. I want to see Jack Morris. I want to see these guys compete against the best lineups. Sandy Koufax, this is how we remember baseball, and it's a huge part of the game, and I'm glad so far it's back. Look at what Cam Schlittler did against the Red Sox.
Amazing. Howard Bryant, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Scott.
President Trump wants far more homeless Americans with addiction and mental illness sent to institutions. The idea is spelled out in one of his executive orders. And NPR's Brian Mann spent time with a family in Oregon that experienced this kind of forced medical care, and they say it can be life-saving. They also fear that it could be misused.
Mid-morning Judy Thompson makes coffee in her tidy kitchen in St. Helens, Oregon, a small town near Portland.
How about a Dove? For you.
Thompson, who's 73, takes me into her living room, which she's turned into a kind of headquarters. She's a leading activist in Oregon, lobbying for better services for people with mental illness, a campaign that began in the 90s when her son fell ill.
He kept saying, you know who I am, you know who I am. And finally, he just said, I'm God. It was horrible. It was crushing.
Her son was diagnosed with bipolar schizoaffective disorder. I've come to meet Thompson because she testified this year in favor of Oregon's new civil commitment law just enacted, which makes it easier for judges to force people facing severe addiction or mental illness into care, including institutionalization. Thompson says she came to believe government-mandated hospital care should be used more often. After her son's illness spiraled out of control in 2019, he began refusing to take his medication, and the episode ended in a car chase with police.
He hit a car that hit another car, very totaled. He popped up out of the car and introduced himself as a U.S. Marshal.
No one was killed, but Thompson says her son put other people in grave danger and wound up with a criminal record, all before a judge finally agreed to send him to a mental hospital.
This thing where you have to wait till they've hurt themselves or they've hurt somebody else. We need some wiggle room before things collapse and end up in this big, horrific, horrible nightmare.
A lot of states have some form of civil commitment law, and Oregon's not alone in moving to expand its use. California and New York have also made it easier to mandate health care for addiction and mental illness. President Trump campaigned for a second term in part on the idea that the U.S. should use this legal process more aggressively to force people living on the streets into institutions. Here he is speaking in 2023.
And for those who are severely mentally ill and deeply disturbed, we will bring them back to mental institutions where they belong.
Trump signed an executive order this summer urging state and local officials to ramp up use of long-term institutionalization as a way to reduce homelessness, crime, and disorder on American streets. I asked Thompson what she thinks about Trump's idea. She says she's skeptical.
It can be used for good or bad. It can be used to help or to harm.
She says her caution comes from her experience seeing this from both sides, fighting at times to have her son committed to an institution, but also seeing up close what it's like to have the government take a person's freedom.
I wouldn't want that. You know, so what's the medium? Where's the middle ground where people can meet?
Thompson takes me across the street to her son's apartment.
Nice to meet you. Okay, if I just come on in?
Sure.
Thank you.
They've been close neighbors now for years. 6 years after that car crash that led to his last hospitalization, Alton Anderud is 53, and he's doing well. His small home is even more tidy than his mother's. We sit, and he talks about a life redefined by mental illness.
You know, I look at myself for a long time, and man, I have this horrible, horrible illness.
At times, Anderud's illness was so severe it left him homeless and led to repeated hospitalizations and run-ins with police. Now he lives with a lot of independence, thanks to medications and therapy. I ask if he agrees there were times when he needed civil commitment and institutional care.
Yes, primarily yes, but civil commitment is very scary because you don't know what you're getting into.
This is where their skepticism about Trump's executive order comes in. Anderud and his mother agree civil commitment should be used only when absolutely necessary, after all other interventions have been tried, and hospitalization should be the shortest possible period of time. But the idea of using long-term institutionalization to reduce crime and homelessness, as Trump proposes, worries them.
It's case by case, not just throw them all in an institution. That's wrong.
It's like to throw the garbage away. And it's horrifying.
Trump has described long-term institutionalization as tough but compassionate, a way to protect the public while stabilizing people he describes as dangerously deranged. A senior White House official who spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity said Trump's executive order would be implemented by states in ways that respect people's rights. Anderud worries the government could wind up forcing too many people into institutions for too long. His experience left him convinced civil commitment, even under the best circumstances, is traumatic. He says it left him isolated, his already fragile life in shambles.
When I got out of Oregon State Hospital, I spent 5 months there, and I had nothing when I came home. No place to live. One pair of pants, one shirt, pair of shoes. It's disheartening when you just go, geez, I'm going to be back at square one again.
With help from his mom, Anderud was able to rebuild his life. But a lot of the homeless people who are Trump's focus don't have that kind of support. Anderud says if overused, civil commitment could damage Americans with addiction and mental illness, leaving them more vulnerable than before they were institutionalized. Brian Mann, NPR News, St. Helens, Oregon.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. It's Fashion Week in Paris, where runway shows often play compositions by BJ Lederman, who does our theme music. And as NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, artificial intelligence is now being used to help retailers help figure out emerging fashion trends.
Predicting what matters in fashion was once an elite sport, the province of those who attend the big runway shows in New York, Milan, London and Paris, like the editors of influential magazines.
You still don't get it, do you? Her opinion is the only one that matters.
This clip comes from the 2006 movie The Devil Wears Prada, about a tyrannical fashion editor. Amy Sullivan is a vice president at the online fashion retailer and styling service Stitch Fix. She says while elite opinions continue to carry weight, the trend prediction game has expanded enormously over the past decade.
There is more information available, certainly, and I think the trends, because of social media, move faster.
Platforms like TikTok, Instagram, and Pinterest are redefining how trends spread. And the top style influencers have millions of followers, like Emma Chamberlain.
Let's do this skirt.
With so much data floating around, fashion industry players are relying on AI in order to remain competitive. Stitch Fix's Amy Sullivan says AI recently helped her team decide whether to go with a red or blue striped shirt for next spring.
In the past, to answer that question, you either make a spot decision without really looking at it, or you're requesting samples from vendors overseas that could take weeks and cost a lot of money. But when this happened a few weeks ago, we just put it into AI.
They went with the blue. Noémie Voyer is the fashion expertise lead at Euritech. The Paris-based company's AI models help brands like New Balance and Prada figure out what's likely to fly off the racks next season.
Our models track everything from runway shows to social media. So we have a massive scale of data that allows our AI to detect early signal of trends, sometimes months before they become visible on the mainstream market.
Voyer says her company's algorithms successfully predicted a bunch of emerging trends for next year. Examples include dotted prints, the flat thong sandal, and the colour yellow. These trends have all shown up on runways at this year's Fashion Weeks. Eventually, they'll appear in Target and H&M.
While our AI is extremely sophisticated, the human still remains essential.
Francesca Mustin agrees.
We can use AI to supercharge what we do, but you have to really start putting a lot of rigor and a lot of process into what you're doing.
Mustin is the chief forecasting officer at the global consumer trend forecasting company WGSN. Its clients include Levi's and Coach. Mustin says AI is excellent at efficiently predicting things like how much of a popular item a retailer should stock, but she says her company's human experts have to ensure the information the AI provides doesn't lead to the wrong conclusions.
When you're looking online at social media, trends can blow up and feel huge. But entertainment and commerciality are two different things.
Mustin says it's one thing for an entertaining fashion post on social to get a ton of engagement, but another for someone to go out and buy the featured item. That's why you have to have humans fact-checking the algorithms. And not all AIs are set up to gaze into fashion's crystal ball. Like when this reporter asked for a little style advice and got therapy instead.
Okay, Google, tell me what I should wear this fall.
Wear what makes you happy. I'm sure you'll look sensational.
Okay then, yellow skirt, blue striped shirt, and flat thong sandals it is. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:39. You're listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. At 9 o'clock, it is Stay Human, a mix of story and song. This week, we'll hear more stories from our recent Authentic Voice Storytelling Concert. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Support comes from Summer Muse Festival in Bemidji, a monthly all-inclusive music and creative arts gathering that is open to the public at Rail River Folk School. The final event will be held Saturday, October 18th from 4 to 8. More information at summermusefestival.com. We also receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Another warm day in northern Minnesota with sunny skies, highs in the mid to upper 80s, lows tonight in the mid 60s, and tomorrow, mostly sunny, chance of showers, highs 77 to 80, cooling off by Monday.
With these headlines, Israel and Hamas appear to be moving forward on President Trump's plan to bring the war in Gaza to an end. Hamas has accepted parts of the plan, including the release of hostages, and Israel's military said it would advance plans to prepare for the first phase. However, there were at least three strikes in Gaza today. Ukrainian officials say a Russian drone strike hit a passenger train at a station northeast of Kyiv. Dozens of people were injured. Russia has been stepping up strikes on Ukrainian infrastructure. And Japan's ruling party has elected Sanae Takaichi as its new leader. Her election today makes her likely to become Japan's first woman prime minister. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Some people text, some email, but you know, it's really lovely to get an actual letter from a friend, especially if it's a letter poem. Dear Acorn, Love Oak is a new children's book of letter poems to friends.
A letter poem is when you're addressing someone else. The way I write them, you're starting out saying, this is why I'm writing to you. This is why I'm intrigued by you. And these are the things I want to know about you.
That's award-winning poet Joyce Sidman. Still just a little foggy on what a letter poem might sound like? Well, here's one we wrote just for you, dear listener. You know, we often think of you out there on the other side of the microphone, attentive, interested in the world. We wonder what you're eating for breakfast. Cereal, scrambled eggs, yogurt. Your whole weekend is ahead of you. Well, thanks for turning on your radio or asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. With love, Weekend Edition.
So it's kind of a poem to connect with someone else. But it doesn't have to be a person.
In the title of Joyce Sidman's children's book, an oak tree writes, Dear Acorn, I feel you there, a tickle at my twig tips, a plump promise against my rough bark. And the acorn writes back, I'll stretch up my arms, strong and true. I'll be your friend, the one who rises up beside you.
The idea for this book came to me actually when I picked up an acorn in the forest and was thinking about how an entire oak tree resided in this acorn. And it's about how small things are part of big things and big things need small things.
And author Joyce Sidman needed illustrator Melissa Sweet to create this picture book about pen pal pairs and to talk about it for our series, Picture This.
Well, we start with an acorn and an oak tree. There's a droplet and a cloud. There's a brick and a school. What am I forgetting, Melissa?
There's a button and a coat.
A bubble and the sky.
When I received this packet of poems by Joyce, I read Dear River from the pebble. So it's, Dear River, I've jittered and danced in your silvery arms, tumbled asleep to your burbling song, chattered and rolled as you scoured me smooth, and drop me to rest in a small, still pool. Now I gleam in the sand like an awestruck eye, watch the moon grow round in its silver of sky. Quietly yours, Pebble. When I got that poem, I felt so emotive, and I thought, oh my goodness, I've never thought about the world from the point of view of a pebble looking up at the moon through the river.
I could read to the ocean from the baby sea turtles, just as they're hatching. Dear ocean, we've waited and watched till the moon grows bright, till the night grows cool and the time is right. Into sweet dark air, onto slanting strand, a cauldron of flippers, we erupt from the sand. Plunging and climbing the soft, crumbly peaks, scrambling past danger of sharp claws and beaks. The moon lights our runway. We know what to do. We speed to our future, to you, from your baby sea turtles.
So how do I do that visually? I begin by painting watercolor papers on a very thin paper that I have, so I'm creating my own collage materials. One of the things I love to do is take the inside of envelopes that we receive in the mail that have a pattern in them, plaid or a little erratic marking that, of course, hides what the bill is. But when I open up the envelope, I can Xerox them. And then I send my hand-painted watercolor paper through my Xerox machine, and now I have watercolor paper with these great little patterns on them. I'll do anything to try to make a fun pattern.
Make sure you tell about the bubble wrap.
Yeah, that's funny. I forgot about that. The bubble is writing to the sky, and I often do a very simple printing process called jelly printing. Taking bubble wrap and pressing it on ink on the plate, and then pulling the bubble wrap away, you get this gorgeous pattern of circles reminiscent of bubbles. And that's another great thing about the artist's prerogative, is that it doesn't have to be photographic realism. As a naturalist, I keep a lot of journals about the natural world, and I care deeply about how I draw, say, a pileated woodpecker. But there's a pileated woodpecker near the oak tree, and its crest is hot pink, and it's such fun to be able to just throw all the rules away and say, we can do whatever we want in this beautiful picture book.
And somehow it looks even more like a pileated woodpecker with hot pink. I don't know why.
I know, and hot pink legs. I just think, yeah, it works for the page so beautifully. Have to go with it.
I just love poring over those illustrations because there's always more to find. It's like you're opening up the world with all these little secrets in your illustration.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it starts with the words. So I am in awe of your poet's voice, Joyce. It doesn't come natural to everybody, but once you hear it, you can't think of the world in the same way again.
I always express myself more precisely and probably more in a heartfelt way on paper. That's why I love letter writing, because I can say exactly what I want.
I love to send off envelopes filled with fun stuff on top of them. There's nothing better than to get something interesting in your mailbox. Now I'm going to send you a letter, okay? I'm just going to send you a letter.
It's going to be beautiful.
Look for it, yeah.
Author Joyce Sidman and illustrator Melissa Sweet talking about their new children's book, Dear Acorn, Love, Oak, Letter Poems to Friends. Our series Picture This is produced by Samantha Balaban. And for more conversations like this very one, you can head to npr.org/picturethis. The Grammy Award-winning rapper Lecrae has put his Christian faith at the center of his music. In his new album, Reconstruction, he shares how it's changed his life and also offers some advice to people who've had a bad experience with church.
I understand why people don't want to deal with the church. They've experienced the blasphemers, the bad teachers, the cash seekers, these people who should be shepherds and leaders and guides and carers for the soul, who are, you know, being tyrants instead of loving leaders. I want to say I see this with you, and I still have not left the faith. keep pressing forward and don't give them the power of stealing away something so beautiful and transformative from you. Hey, feeling like easy, baby. I was losing my mind, gave up all of my time, but it never got easy, baby. Well, it's shame on me, feel the rain on me, it ain't been my season lately. Trying to get through the day, I break down when I pray. I don't know what to say, help me, I'm about to drown, 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 drown.
If you can't. What's being reconstructed? What are you trying to rebuild?
It's not so much of what is being reconstructed, it's what has been reconstructed. This album was birthed out of the work that I think I spent the last 5 years doing. Some of it is spiritual, obviously, reconstructing my faith. Some of it is relational, reconstructing my family and marriage. But a lot of it is the idea that oftentimes we learn new things and we find ourselves disoriented at how things don't quite work out the way we like them to. Some of the failures and things that have not worked out are cause to reconstruct and to build something different and better.
Can we talk about your early years?
Sure. By all means.
I gather raised by a single mother, grew up seeing a lot of poverty, drugs, and I gather you survived sexual abuse from a babysitter.
That's right.
What do you make of those things now?
Well, the good thing about, those traumatic events happening to you as a child, if there's any silver lining, is that your brain isn't developed enough to understand everything that's happening. So though it was traumatic, some of those things have shaped me in some difficult ways, but more than anything, they've created a resilience. And I think it helps me connect to people. There's nothing I can hear about from other people that would be too off-putting for me and make me feel like I can't help you, I can't relate.
I lost hope in humanity many moons ago. Took the sun to remind me the moon is just for show. Reflecting light, it has no light of its own. Without the sun, it's just a dark, cold, perilous globe. I mean, I probably had to take you back, but how far though? Back when me and mama rode the bus because our car broke. Back when I was in my early teens, having dreams about being your favorite rapper, but none of it's what it seems. Baby, the crime scene.
Can I ask what brought you to religion?
So ironically, my mother grew up in a bit of a religious cult. She wasn't allowed to wear pants or lipstick or go to sporting events. And because of that, she did not want me to participate in organized religion. She just wanted me to be a free thinker so I would not have to face the same abuse that she endured. But I was still curious. I think every human being comes to a place where they wonder, what's the purpose of life? What is their meaning? Why are they here? And those questions led me to explore religion.
Holy Spirit, patiently waiting, nothing forsaken. Started stirring my faith, it was gentle and never shaken. The Bema podcast and Marty Solomon's words. I read a couple books by Lois Taverberg. Many sermons by Tony Evans and Charlie Dates. I felt the Lord showing his face, giving me grace. Corrected vision when my eyes got blurry. I get a Lord glory, he changed my whole story like.
Christianity was the only one that really kind of answered those deeper questions for me. It wasn't about how I can reach God through my trying and my efforts and my abilities. It was more about God reaching down and saying, you're going to need me to pull you up. And that's an existential experience, meeting Jesus at 19 years old. I felt a peace come over me that I've never experienced before. I felt welcomed. I felt loved. I felt forgiven. It was like a new being was emerging where I took off all my jewelry and ran outside and started to give it away to people on the street. Like it's something I would have never done.
I gather that having a Bible in your car saved you from arrest during an encounter with the police.
That's absolutely correct. I was throwing parties and, some friends of mine were also selling drugs. I was taking part in some aspects of it. And I went to a high school to do some promotion for the party. Of course, I have some drugs in my car. The police had caught me trespassing on the high school property. So I hurry up, got to my car. I was met at my car by more police officers. They detained me, put me in the back of the squad car, and then they started to search my car. And this particular officer who searched my car, he came back to me. At the time, I had a Bible on my dashboard. My grandmother gave me a Bible. And there were highlights and markers and markings and notes and just so much in there. And he took his time and read through some of those things. And he comes back to the car and he says, "Is that your Bible?" I say, "Yes, sir." He says, "Is that you doing all that marking and reading it?" He said, "Yes." I say, "Yes, sir." He said, "Man, I'm gonna let you go." I know he's got his hands on me. He said, "I want you to get in that Bible and I want you to take it seriously and live it out." So I get back in the car, my drugs are gone. You know, I'm like, okay, I think he just let me go.
Oh my. God be praised.
Man, I'm telling you.
Well, what was that like for you? Humbling?
It was humbling. It to me was like a sign. Like, hey, I'm giving you a chance here. Get it together.
People who don't share your faith listen to your music?
I would hope they do. No one is speaking from a vacuum. Everyone is speaking from a place of belief or unbelief. There's a value, a worldview, a sense of morality in every piece of art that comes out. Tons of people who are not Christians love Lord of the Rings, as do I. You know, a Christian wrote that book and his worldview is embedded in the book. It doesn't make it less great. It's just that you begin to see things from a different vantage point. And I think that's what my music is. It's for those who share my faith, they can probably see those themes very vividly. For those who don't, they may not see it, but they may appreciate the topics that I bring up and the vantage points that I have. He's got his hands on me. He's my eyes when I can't see.
I know this prayer's for me. His prayer's for me. Lecrae, his new album, Reconstruction. Thank you so much for being with us.
Man, thank you. I appreciate the time and the opportunity. And my brother got headphones in heaven. I hope he hear the song. Yeah, hey. And my mama got headphones in heaven. I hope she hear the song. Yeah, we went from nothing to hundreds to millions. Man, who would have thunk it? We went from running and ducking to running a Fortune 500. All of my people who had me down, now we lifting them up. Ain't no more stressing or struggling or dreading the first of the month. Ain't no. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Granny said count your blessings, but if I could count them, it'd take me some months. Wish you could see me now, living clean, God, I'm calling me reverend.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is just about 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, it is Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's stories from our Authentic Voice Storytelling Concert that recently occurred. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Sunny today, highs in the mid to upper 80s, breezy south winds, 15 to 30 miles per hour. Lows tonight in the mid 60s and tomorrow mostly sunny, chance of showers, high 77 to 80. By Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 50s. There will be a candlelight vigil at Angel of Hope Park in Grand Rapids this Monday. Those grieving the loss of a child, no matter what age, and supporters will gather for a brief ceremony at 6 o'clock. The park is located on the south bank of the Mississippi River, two blocks off Pakegama Avenue. There will be refreshments and music at River Grand following the vigil. Pine River Market Square will hold an indoor growers market and crafters market next Saturday, October 11th, 10 to 2 at the warehouse on Norway Avenue in Pine River. Local band Every Bird will provide live music. It's time for Stay Human on KAXE.
Hi there, friends. I'm glad you're here.